Fume on the radio.
On lookout FM.
What's up, party people? Welcome to Perfume on the Radio. This is a bi-monthly program presented by the Institute for Art and Olfaction. If you don't know about us, we're a nonprofit organization devoted to experimentation and access in the field of perfumery. We're based here in the always sunny Los Angeles, where the people are beautiful and cheerful, and the smells are plentiful. Things are feeling a lot better here, so we're celebrating with a little bit of Mozart. I'm Saskia Wilson-Brown, and I will be your host for today's episode. We recorded this episode in February and March of 2021, and because of you-know-what, we've been limited by the tools at hand. No fancy sound booths, no connecting in person, in fact. I'm definitely not one for making excuses, but for that reason, our audio is not as stellar as we'd like it to be. However, I hope that we make up for it with the complexity and intelligence of today's guest. Speaking of our guest, for people who are interested in experimental practices with scent, our guest probably needs no introduction, but we're going to do it anyway. I first met Sissel Tolas in 2012 in Berlin when she graciously allowed me to come over and interview her for a now defunct documentary project. I walked into her studio and I was met with this tall and beautiful person with this unruly blonde bob and a polite and pretty direct conversational style. She was accompanied by an ambient smell that sort of pervaded her entire studio. It was warm and it was musky, but it also had a little bit of an edge, kind of like Sissel herself. Looking back and trying to sort of delve into my deepest scent memories, I'm pretty sure it may have had something to do with this molecule that I love called Cashmeran, which is a warm and enveloping sort of musky smell. But it also has a little bit of a frenetic edge to it, which makes for a really interesting juxtaposition. Anyway, her space was bright and airy and of course tasteful. It had big, beautiful windows that let in all the light. It was bohemian and it had beautiful parquet floors. I don't know, basically walking into that space, I was kind of reminded that life can be amazing and the world contains pretty impressive people. So those were my fragmented impressions of Sissel. In contrast to that, here is her official bio that I cribbed from her page on Cooper Hewitt's website. Sissel Tolas is a smell designer, artist, chemist, researcher, odor theorist, a professional in-betweener, as she calls it, working amid research, commercial, and creative innovation. Smell is Sissel's medium, but her interest is not a conventional approach to scent, which is characterized typically by perfumes that camouflage, deodorize, and sanitize reality. Not for Sissel. For her, smell is information. She composes provocative smells to stimulate memory, recreate place, capture seasonality, and arouse emotional and intellectual responses. She stimulates complex and often transgressive olfactory experiences to enhance smell sensibilities. She investigates and develops language to communicate smell. She values sensory experience as a way to heighten reality. Born in Norway, but currently based in Berlin, Sissel studied mathematics, classical science, language, and visual arts in Norway, Poland, Russia, and the United Kingdom. In 2004, with support from International Flavors and Fragrance, Inc., Sissel founded the Smell Research Lab, a workspace to research, develop, and execute smell-related projects for institutional, educational, and individual clients. She joined us for this chat from that amazing studio in Berlin that I mentioned earlier, the Smell Research Lab. She has been using the lockdown wisely, preparing for a whole lot of new projects, which she'll tell us about momentarily, but that include a solo show at a museum in Norway to open in October of 2021. I started our conversation asking her to tell us about the beginning of her practice in the early 90s, and we kind of expanded from there. I think I've adequately introduced this remarkable woman, so without further ado, I'd like to launch episode 6 of Perfume on the Radio, The Sissel Show. And here is Sissel.
In the beginning, it was the smell, you know. Before the word, it was the smell. So in my life, too, that's probably the case. And, you know, from the very early on, even in the belly of my mother, I was determined to do what I'm now doing, you know, with the passion and the commitment that's still in there and in me and drive what I do.
What were your first curiosities about smell?
In the beginning of the 90s, I was very curious about the invisible reality that surrounds me, the air that I breathe. I mean, in general, I've been interested in that since very early age.
From quite young, huh?
Yeah. As a child, I was curious about nature. I was curious about the air. I was curious about all this phenomena that we cannot actually see and hear, but seem to kind of determine who we are and where we are and what is going on. And it was very abstract at that time, you know, and also very naive. I found myself very naive asking these kind of questions, you know, and somehow, you know, these questions I still ask. So in the end, maybe I am very naive, you know, to be in the world of smell and full time, you probably need to be naive. Curiosity is what drives me, you know, and towards smell, there's always something to discover.
Yeah, totally. I understand that your first explorations into scent came from an interest in the air that surrounds us. Can you tell us about that a bit?
So beginning of the 90s, I was interested in this topic of air. Started off with asking questions about the weather. What is weather? You know, what does it mean? Coming from Scandinavia, where literally the topic of the weather is everything, from business to leisure to pleasure, and still people only speak about bad and good weather. Something must be wrong. I tried to make small experiments around, you know, weather, forcing non-existing weather and confronting with various type of weather with each other for the purpose primarily to challenge language. The challenge, how do we actually talk about this weather we don't know so well, you know?
Yeah, totally.
So through those kind of experiments, I then discovered, wow, those explosions caused by chemical experiments actually cause more interesting smellscapes and they cause various types of weather. So I said, wow, that smell is interesting. What is it? And how can I make sense out of it? And so that's how it started. Literally, like in Newton's case, you know, apple falling on the head. For me, like, wow, that's it. I decided, okay, what do I need to study to somehow get to understand this topic? Yeah, mm-hmm. The invisible reality that surrounds me full time, all the time.
Yeah.
What kind of knowledge do I need to look into to be able to maybe find the answer to those questions? Mm-hmm. So I studied, you know, chemistry because math and chemistry and science was always passion in my life. And linguistics, because I was always very curious in how do I talk about what I'm doing? How do I talk about this, in this case, the invisible reality? There seemed to be no language out there, so maybe I have to invent one day. At very early age, I was so clear that these are literally the tools. Chemistry, you know, chemical communication is all about communication, you know, smell is all about communication, you know, information, communication. And then linguistics and, you know, semantics, etc., language, how do you communicate certain issues, yeah?
Yeah, totally.
So in the end, then I kind of started a journey. I didn't know where I was heading. As long as there's a footstep on the moon, the sky was not the limit. And off I took.
So what were your first steps?
I decided to use myself as a guinea pig to explore the capacity of what I'm able to understand about the sense of smell on my own body and in my own system, in my own metabolism, so to say. And also, you know, how do I use smell? How could I potentially use smell if I understand it properly? If I train every day to smell, would I improve my sense of smell? Would I understand smell beyond what I thought I could? You know, and all the questions I had in my backpack, you know, smell and prejudice, smell and language, smell and rationality, smell and emotion, smell and memory, you name it. The list is long and my backpack was big. I really, you know, set off a journey and used myself to test myself, starting off with one fact. We are a very complex system as humans, and we are equipped with amazing, I call it software on the hardware or interfaces called the senses. And these senses are there for a purpose. So what if I'm able to understand what these senses are there to do and how they actually operate? somehow I understand how looking and hearing and touching operate, and I make sense out of it. But the sense of smell always lingering out there. Why is that? Why is that sense somehow not so conscious in the way I understand the use of the senses? And also in this complexity, the way we use the senses in a complex way is never really we only not smelling or only looking. There is always interaction between all the senses. So my methodology was then literally to force the process of smelling. I have understood so much that whatever I have had access to in terms of smelling in my early years from zero to puberty most likely will be in my subconsciousness. Maybe now when I force myself to smell, all those smell references will come up just like, wow, you know, like, oh, yeah, they are there. Oh, yes, I know what they are. And that was a very interesting process to discover that if you efficiently try to smell something and you look for the reference, you find it. I discovered in my own system that my subconsciousness, my storage of memory was packed. And I literally had made no attempt to use all that information in smell. And that was like, wow, how sad is that? Because it seemed to be so efficient. Yeah.
Yeah.
So all this literally using myself to do experiments on myself and my skill to go beyond what I suspected and dare to do, you know, literally jump into deep water, not even being able to swim properly. Challenge myself, force myself in terms of prejudices, force myself. Tolerance was a big issue. I found myself very early also having a lot of prejudices because smell and memory and bad experience, you know, your relation to those smells remain negative unless you want to change it. Right. Because I also remember that once upon a time, I had been very, very tolerant. So that must be something there that by nature, we are born neutral because of survival, you know.
Adapting.
Yeah, adapting to various settings because you need to survive somehow. The body and the senses are super smart.
They are, totally.
But what is so essential is that experiencing all this through my own body was essential for me coming to the point in 1997, wow, that's it. You know, I literally have my job carrying it with me. You know, my tools are on my body. My topic is life. And that was like, wow, that's amazing.
How were you doing this? Were you literally smelling things that you thought you might have a memory associated with, or were you more smelling things at random and seeing if they triggered something?
Everything. I did all this, what you just mentioned. Hardcore, you know, very precise, and then, you know, looking for the memory. If I hadn't smelled it before, I consciously placed it in my memory, and I did, you know, various exercises to test if it would stay there, you know? Mm. I built up a kind of coding system, you know, internal coding system. And then I discovered that I was capable, and also the issue of chemistry, how can I potentially replicate and reproduce some of the smell if I need to kind of take them out of their storage and use them? Yeah. So these are kind of questions I had long before I had got access to the existing knowledge, which, you know, I then got later on. But I was kind of interested how to operate, how to use this type of information. So literally, yeah, using all this, you know, moment to figure out the extremes.
That must have been quite a bit of work.
Yeah.
Was there a eureka moment in there for you?
Yeah, there was a moment where I suddenly started to relate to smell very rationally. Like it had been very emotional. That's one of the quality of smell, that it's linked to emotion so strongly. And having emotion is what makes us humans. So it's amazing. But the moment I discovered I was able to relate to a smell rationally, that was when I was like, so convinced, this is it. Only then the issue of tolerance could be possible.
Right. So how did this manifest?
So I could go into a setting. The setting was maybe unbearable if I turn on my emotion. But the moment I turn on my rational part of my brain, I was just like, yeah, wow.
So what do you mean by rational? Do you mean you would be more analytical about what you were smelling than reactive?
Yeah, analytical and thinking chemistry, thinking compound, thinking, you know, just like I see a picture and I have no emotions towards it, just see it as information. Yeah?
Yeah, got it.
I developed kind of methodology to do that, kind of strategy working, how to do this. It's like turning on and off, you know, it's like, oh yeah, no, I'm totally in an emotional relation to the smell, and no, just turn off the emotion and be rational and understand that smell. What is it? What does it come from? What does it contain? What are the molecules? What's the structure of that smell? And I'm still going back and forth, you know, and then understanding, wow, that is the skill we have, everyone. Some maybe have some disability towards the senses, and then the other senses operate even more strong, you know. So understanding that kind of parameters was for me so amazing, and still is, you know. It's just like, wow, you know.
Yeah.
It's never ending story. And that's also when, for example, my daughter asked me, Mama, when are you stopping to work? You know, when is it enough? I said, Tara, my topic is life and being alive. If I die, maybe then I stop, you know, but maybe not.
I don't know. Depends. Maybe you'll be smelling the decomposition from the grave if I know you.
So it's all about being curious, you know.
Yeah. Does the analytical, rational approach help one make sense of things like dying and death and decay?
Science is important here, you know, like we all know, you know, like hardcore science, understanding, trying to understand, you know, beyond the imaginative. It's very important. For my work, it's fundamental. I think also in the world, in the profession of smell and the whole topic, all the science that has kind of been added in the last 20 years is one of the reasons why smell have also moved on a completely different direction than it was when I started, for example, you know, because of all these factors, definitely, you know.
Yeah.
And also the understanding of what's a smell compound, what is a volatile, what's a smell molecule, what is it? It's all abstract if you don't really, you know, have access to the knowledge properly, you know, which I then happen to have. And for me, even was completely, you know, a complex issue. I just started to sense there's variation there, you know, that the smell I smell yesterday, I went to the same spot, but today I smell different. So how come is that? And at that time, I didn't have other devices than my own nose. So I started to train my nose to be very sophisticated. And I always traveled with a small tool, a small kind of training. Like I had very big concerns about fitness. And I decided that time that, wow, I better also train my senses. Otherwise, they might also decay. Somehow there was this intuition of, yeah, that makes sense, you know. And that's still the case. I mean, there's not one day I don't train my nose.
When you first started these trainings and becoming interested in this field and sort of diving right in, at some point you decided to set up your laboratory, right?
No, so from 1990 until 97, I mean, I've been literally traveling the world, and I ended up in East Europe because I had come to this to the point that, let me place myself in a complete other world, you know, where I don't understand the language, where I don't have access to material goods because it was in the middle of the, you know, of the changes in East Europe. So it was an excellent moment to experience the world from a different perspective. And coming from the West Coast of Norway was like, you know, I was determined to take over the family business, and I kind of escaped everything by going more and more eastwards, you know, where I got more and more challenges and challenged myself in multiple ways, language, intellectually and emotionally, and ended up in Russia. And that's really changed my life, you know, where I was so dependent of exactly this invisible and my skill to be independent, you know, was so essential there. That I could enjoy my own company and sit down and always have something to do because of what I just said, you know, the topic of concern was my own breath, literally. So after Moscow, I then moved to West Berlin, and it was called West Berlin that time. So I decided I make Berlin as my hub because I was still very connected to East Europe, you know, and I used it a lot and traveled a lot and kept my connections to Moscow and to Warsaw. And my daughter's also half Russian. So it's for me a very important kind of, source in terms of, you know, intellectual kind of substance. You know, I was always fascinated by culture and by literature, by philosophy. So I got to a point where I said, yeah, what do I do now? You know, now I've spent all these years experiencing what the sense of smell is, what the device or interface, nose and sensors, wherever we have them on the body, are capable of doing, you know. What do I do now? So I had never in my life, till then, Saskia, used perfume or deodorant or any smell added on my body, you know, for whatever purpose. Somehow it was not in my system to think I had to. And I think that also probably was because I was very much outdoor. I was totally alert. I was very, you know, in the moment. I was living very heavily in the moment, literally, and observing the moment full time. So somehow there was, I tried to be as naked, as a metaphor, as possible, to take in the all the information I could. And that continued. That's still the case, you know. Now it's a little bit different because now I do things other ways, yeah. But, yeah, so I got to a point like, okay, what now, you know? Is there any knowledge there I can dock onto or learn more from? And might be someone that can, you know, take me on internship, etc., to you know, to explore what is possible and what is not. And there was a moment where I understood, oh, there's a whole industry called perfumery, you know, detergent and, you know, soap and sanitizer, you name it, I say it. I had no clue existed, yeah? And started to kind of looked into, wow, what is that? How can I get access to that? So I had an invitation to do a project in Paris at the Fondation Cartier. I knew that France was, you know, parfum, you know, and scent was a kind of topic that everybody knew. So I asked the Cartier Foundation, this was in 97, I think. It was one of my first projects ever in the institution like that. So I reached out to them. I said, by the way, do you think there could be a laboratory in Paris that I could work with or work in? I have a PhD in chemistry, organic chemistry. I have a skill to use whatever chemical, if there is something that we call chemical and smell. Anyway, so long story short, I accomplished to work with the lab of Quest at that time before Quest fused with Givaudan.
So as a quick aside for those who don't know, Quest was a fragrance and flavors producer that was acquired by Givaudan, another fragrance house based in Switzerland, in a merger that finalized in 2008.
So I collaborated with the Quest lab in France and developed my work. Hmm. And that was for me like, wow, what a knowledge. But why is that knowledge so limited? Yeah. How come they only are after covering up the reality? Why are they not concerned about how the reality actually smells?
So by that, you mean that they focus on hiding body odor, like hiding reality in a way, yeah?
Yeah, not hiding. It's just, you know, I don't even, the rhetoric, you know, is not necessarily that, you know, but a lot of promises that was not necessarily meant to be kept, you know, marketing had taken over with the science had left, literally. It was so obvious, yeah? And nothing bad or good. It's just somehow I had a feeling that the knowledge had gotten stuck because it was comfortable to be in that position.
I see.
And it was a lot of mystery around it. There was a lot of secrets around it. It was like, yeah, it's a little, it's kind of cucumber on its own. You know, very interesting to kind of peek in and look, oh my God, what's that? What are those containers? You know, what's inside? How does that work, you know? And nobody wanted to tell me. And nobody was interested to know. The less one knew, the more people were, you know, satisfied with the situation. So I said, okay, that seemed very hermetic and kind of conservative. My point of view is much too radical. You know, this is, you know, a young sister full of enthusiasm. She's going to revolutionize, you know, the world of smell and, you know, hope that the industry will like immediately open the door. Nevertheless, so I did an amazing project for the Fondation Cartier. Comme des Garçons was based in Paris, still based in Paris, reached out to me, said they saw my work and said, wow, that's amazing. Would you like to work with us? And I said, no, I'm not interested in perfume. I'm interested in the knowledge of smell. can you make me get access to this in a sophisticated way? Then I might consider working with you. It never really happened. I was on the board of conceptually consulting for a couple of years, you know, on and off. But in the end, this was the beginning of 2000. I happened to meet Nicolas Mirzayan from IFF, and somebody introduced me privately, and we started to talk about the topic, and I told him what I'm doing, and, you know, it was very interesting coincidence that he happened to at that time be the vice president of the department of fragrance and fine fragrance, etc. Mm-hmm. in IFF. Yeah, mm-hmm. So we kept in touch. It was 2001, and we kept kind of meeting each other all over the world. And at one point, he came up to me and said, "Sissel, would you like to work for us?" And I said, "No, would you like to work with me?" And I think he was so surprised and so somehow positive surprised that I had so much confidence that he said, "Oh, that's interesting. Let me look into it." And, you know, this is a company that Wall Street, you know, any kind of decision need a couple of months to be decided, and not just, you know, the board and what's the purpose, you know, the kind of list of this is, you know, what cannot, you know. Yeah. But to make a long story short, within 2 weeks, I had a contract.
No way.
Yeah.
I mean, these corporations, it takes time usually. That's fast.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. But I think they were as curious as I was. And this moment of curiosity was mutual. And I think that was what, again, chemistry. It was chemistry. It was this curiosity. It was this, let's start this journey together. Let's challenge each other. Let's head to the future. Let's clean up a bit, you know, the knowledge and get somebody from outside to be, you know, to come with fresh to take on certain things. So that was literally my position here.
Is that when you started the Smell Research Lab? Was that
the yes? So yeah. This was then 2002.
Okay,
we started to build up. I started to build up the lab here. I got professionals from New York to come down and started to build up a really professional lab. In the beginning, it was also called IFF Satellite Research Lab Berlin. And then at the later stage, they decided to give me the lab full time. I then continue with the same condition, working primarily with R&D and, you know, research development, and primarily with the science part of IFF, and also looking into the different departments on how to challenge innovation, how to move this knowledge, and also to connect these kind of companies to the reality again, because it seemed for me that had kind of was missing, one missing link. There was a very kind of comfortable part of the world they were very solid in, but the rest somehow didn't exist. So all the topics of concern, climate change, segregation, education, you know, everything that's in my work. So these were like, can you imagine to solve the problem with the smell? Was the questions I placed on the table and what was on my agenda from the very beginning.
Right. So less about making perfume than being experimental and solving problems.
I was not there to make a massive amount of turnover. Maybe I sold 10 kilo of ingredients at maximum.
Right, right. And IFF supported this?
They were very open for my radical point of view. They were very open to collaboration on projects and giving me access to knowledge, bypassing bureaucracy. It was amazing. I'm so thankful. And without that collaboration and that kind of support, I wouldn't be where I am today. Still, I cannot move on without that knowledge, you know. And I got, you know, the condition was and still is that I have to work with their knowledge. I cannot go to somebody else as long as I have a contract. So for me, they have the best anyway. I mean, they are, through me, also have now opened up to the world in a different way, you know, because when I started, it was like a small perfume, no way.
Right, yeah.
100,000 kilo, yes. Even the niche perfumery was completely something new, you know, except for Comme des Garçons. And, you know, if somebody came to me and I can't we make a small perfume, just like 500 bottle. And I presented that to the companies, like, no way, you know, who need that? That's not, just doesn't make any sense, you know, we need money, yeah? And that has really, you know, radically changed. and science are one sense of smell, and neurology, you know, and chemistry, and, you know, and neuroscience. I mean, it's all this have had massive impact on how this knowledge is understood today, and also influence how the you know, chemists and perfumers are formulating, because they have more knowledge and they cannot refuse to take on that knowledge.
Yeah. Was it a challenge to change that mindset?
Yeah. I had sometime, you know, confrontation with the professional nose. I said, do you know that this molecule can do X, Y? They said, we don't want to know. I said, why not? But that's amazing to know. But that, I think, has changed, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah? Oh, no, for sure. I think that's totally changed over the years, thankfully. So switching gears a little bit, I'd like to talk about some of your exhibitions. So a really seminal piece, or a really seminal exhibition that you had, was in 2005, after you'd started the Smell Research Lab. And this was an exhibition called Sweat, Fear, Fear Sweat, where you examined and exhibited the body odors of 20 men that had phobias of other men. Is that correct?
Yeah, among others.
No, you had a lot, I know. I'm just picking a few out to get started.
Yeah. I started that whole survey. Again, my topic is life and being alive, you know, and that's everything from psychological state of mind till city, till micro level of life. And one topic was really the body. Who are we on behalf of how we smell? We have a smell ID that is so unique as a fingerprint. And it seemed that nobody really know that. And that also show itself, you know, the way people use commercial smells, you know, fragrance, etc. If you know how you smell, you will maybe choose differently.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I was curious. I had a commission from MIT to do a project around the senses and technology. And this was in 2004. And I was curious, can I smell a person's psychological state of mind? I'm sure I can, because I am sophisticated. That was my kind of starting point. Like, I am sure I can smell somebody's afraid. I am sure I can smell somebody is happy. So I reached out to Harvard, among others, and got access to a group of anxious men that were part of a research project performed from Harvard. And I decided to start a conversation with this man and convince them to be part of my research on, you know, can I actually smell that you are suffering from fear towards, in this case, other type of human, you know, in various ways. That can be a group of human, that can be a race issue, etc. But these were all 21 men that suffer from phobia towards other human beings. And so I developed a device that these men were carrying on them. So whenever they had a fear attack, this device collected the sweat. So, you know, the fresh sweat, as a metaphor of kind of something has to be kind of, you know, to contaminate it, was sent to me. And I immediately did a headspace and analyzed the original. And then broke up the smell in individual molecules and amplified and replicated and reproduced the collected smells.
Ah, cool. And for those who don't know, headspace analysis allows a person to assess the characteristic of volatile compounds without direct sampling of the material. So in more layman's terms, it's a way of assessing the components of the smells, basically.
Yes. And then in the end, I decided to use the wall at MIT Media Lab to project, to display my replicated body sweats from anxious men. And I developed a technology that's, starting point was encapsulation, which IFF have amazing knowledge on. And I embedded this encapsulated, replicated body sweats into a smell neutral binder. So this combination, this slurry, then was applied to the wall. The wall became the skin of these men.
So basically you painted the smells on the walls, right?
Yes.
Amazing.
So the wall, the whole room was a 200 square meter You entered the room. The only way you could smell was if you touched the skin of the man. So the wall became a skin of the person. And you touched the wall and the smell was up your face. You know, it was amazing. And also these men were lined up next to each other. So kind of also that, the metaphor of crowd and the issues of concern and why they were afraid was also part of the visual appearance of the project, you know, that some were afraid of the others, some were afraid of color of skin. And, you know, it was, it's a very complex project, but none of the men had, there was no name. They were only abstract. They were numbers. So it was not about that you come and you smell the wall and then you get afraid. That's not the topic, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, some people, that's happened also to some people.
Did some people react badly or like with fear?
Yeah, they pre-programmed themselves to think they will get afraid because of the title of the work, you know?
I see.
Yeah, but the decontextualized reality, you know, is a lot of the strategy, the way I work. Take the smell out of its context, replicate it, reproduce it if it's about replication and reproduction, and then place it in a completely different context so that you don't know even know what the smell is in most cases. There are hardly any indications on what the smells are. So I leave it up to the audience always to find out, because there is no bad and good. There is no right or wrong in smell. There's just the smell.
Yeah, good point.
The first time I showed it, I've showed it now all over the world. I mean, 25 various exhibitions, and I'm showing it again this year. I have a big solo show in Norway.
As an aside for our listeners, the show in Norway takes place from October in 2021 to January 2022 at the Astrup Fearnley Museum in Oslo. And Sissel will show work from 25 years of practice.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing. Yes, fantastic. In the biggest museum in Norway, in Oslo. No, so it's a very interesting project that is still very actual, and I have a lot of requests for it now, especially in COVID and fear, and you know.
Yeah, and the anxiety of the other body now too.
Ah, yeah. And also, you know, when I did, you know, all this recordings, and then I study, you know, then I all the databases, you know, compare the data, and also of course collecting the body sweat when they didn't have fear attack and compare the data is part of all the research behind it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also looking into when the person is happy, the profiles are different, the smell profile is different, the molecular structure is different. And there's always something like with the smell DNA, some molecules are remain the same, but then there are various other molecules that's kind of caused by the different psychological state of mind. The way your tear tastes when you are happy is completely different than when the tears you cry when you are sad. And the same is with the body sweats and any kind of fluid coming out of the body. Yeah, it's all about chemistry.
This is Perfume on the Radio, produced by the Institute for Art and Olfaction, which is a nonprofit devoted to experimentation and access in the field of perfumery, based in sunny and beautiful Los Angeles. For those of you just joining us, we're talking to the Berlin-based artist Sissel Tolas. Thanks for listening. Okay, let's talk about another project you've taken on called Nasalo, which, you know, in short description is a language for scent. So your work with this language that you have created in my world comes up over and over again. So I'm curious about what led you to develop that.
Again, back to where I started. As you remember, language was a very important factor. Absolutely. In my approach to the invisible reality. And the lack of language was also one of the massive force that can push me out there to find out and to be reassured that I was equipped properly. I studied, I speak up to 9 languages if I'm efficient. I also have linguistic background. So I was very concerned about how one day would I potentially be able to speak about what I do and give these smells terms beyond a metaphor of bad and good and metonyms like smell like this, smell like that, yeah? Metaphors and also the connotation, you know, how you speak with smell, it smell good, it smell bad, and that's about it, you know, most cultures, unless you, you know, really have culture that live close to smells and smell part of everyday life. language and you know, how to communicate information and smell, how to communicate smell was a very important issue from the very beginning. Mm. So nevertheless, when I started to understand that this is going to be my profession and my life is going to be committed to the topic of smell, I also made an attempt to develop various methodologies of how to potentially develop a language around smell. So I learned a lot from various anthropology, linguists, psychology, linguistics, and develop my own methodology somehow on behalf of that. So whenever I do a project and have done a project over this last 25 years, I always have a recorder with me. Because I work in the field. Being in the field is half my job. So work mm-hmm. with people is essential to what I do. To understand the setting of a smell, to understand the smell. It's not just the smell mm-hmm. itself. It's just like what causing the smell, who are the people, what are the issues in the smell, etc. And when the smell is replicated, reproduced, if I'm able to do that, I bring the smell back to the same setting and have people react to the smell. And they have certain conditions to react to the smell, like there are not more than a certain amount of seconds you have, and there is no time between you smelling and speaking. So literally what I've been recording is very much phonetics, more in direction of paralinguistics than actually semantics. So I'm doing a big project at the moment on paralinguistics in Korea at the moment, and also in Oslo is going to be all the archives for 25 years of recording will be on display with wow. Nasalo. So all these nasalo expressions are pretty abstract. For example, if you look into color, how do we give colors name? Green, red, blue, white does not mean anything either. It's also abstract expressions towards something that's colorful, you know? But there are also various shades of gray. So how do you express that? There are various shades of a smell. So there's no argument not to look into smell and language.
Right. So how do you accomplish it?
Yeah. So I've been recording people's intuitive reaction towards the smell. And they're doing parallel studies. Like 2,000 people have smelled the same smell and expressed towards the smell. And then I have a database that look into and compare the data and make sense out of it and construct abstract expression towards certain smell. So far, this nasalo has been very project-based, not language-based. But phonetically, if I look into the recordings, if some recordings are done in Asia, the sound of some of these expressions are completely different than if they are done, let's say, in Norway. So that is what I'm now doing. The next step will be sound, where smell expressions are expressed on the spot and then broadcasted immediately.
That's a big project.
Yeah, so it's a growing archive. And at the moment, I have 5,700 expressions, and we are doing a publication. And in the work, in a big show in Oslo, I'm also using the language to explain the display that will be on display at the museum. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I use it. I use it when I teach. I use it when I do workshop. I use it wherever I can use when I speak about my work. And also, I mean, commercially, if I do commercial job, which is half of how I survive.
Yeah, of course.
I use those terms, embed them in my concepts, in my proposals, And then, of course, there is translation. But it's like learning another language. You have to want it. It's not just a fantasy language. Not at all. It's really carefully recorded expressions caused by people, by various cultures, various age, etc. It's like an algorithm of a kind, you have a database and then the similarities and then they compose, itself somehow. Yeah,
I've looked at various components of the language over the year, and top of mind, there are some words or sounds that seem super appropriate. Like, for instance, for ashtray, I think the word is puiso. I'm actually not sure how to pronounce it. Actually, I'm curious. Is the pronunciation set in your mind, or is it something that can vary?
It can vary. It can vary. Exactly. And this is also what is mostly a display is the hardcore versions. There are always a variation around each of the expressions. Mostly it's literally giving a kind of indicator there is more there. The topic is out there, So when I display it and when I make it public, it's just fragments of a bigger system. It's really an attempt to, and it is possible. And again, back to knowledge and back to the technology available for do this, it is all there, you know, and you just have to give it a purpose. And yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. You know, I'm building up an Asian archive in China. I'm doing a research platform in Nanjing in China permanently. So there's going to be an institute there in that platform, a research platform that dedicated to language, Mandarin and Cantonese language.
How fantastic.
And the sound, yeah, and the phonetics, paralinguistics in towards well.
Oh, that's amazing. So let's talk about what's coming up for you. You have the CISL platform in China, and you have this exhibition in Oslo.
Yes, and then Smell Heritage Museum in India.
Oh, wow. Have you worked with Heritage in other cities or countries?
Yes, 55 cities so far. And I'm doing the Venice Biennale of Architecture with the big Extinction Project, a collaboration between Christine Agapakis and Daisy Ginsberg and myself.
Fantastic.
I'm doing the Guangzhou Biennale opening 25th of February. The year is packed. You know, I have the big solo show in Oslo where Forma Fantasma is doing the exhibition design. It's going to be amazing. There's some new work and some connecting all the bits and bytes from the 90s where I did a lot of chemistry, a lot of invisible process work. And it's funny to see them together. It's like, oh my God, Cicely, you were determined from the very beginning, you know?
Because
sometimes you tend to forget, you know, what did I do actually in the, you know, 1990, you know? And then someone in Oslo had been collecting all my sketches. And I look into it and I say, oh my God, this is amazing. Did I think that at that time, you know? And also this whole pandemic, you know, what I've been doing is literally rethinking, remembering, recording my 25 years of work.
Yeah.
Being out in the field has been more important for me than to have a website, you know?
Yeah. That's so tricky because you have to record your work and archiving is so important, especially for an artist like you who has worked with, you know, gosh, climate change, language, injustice, functional smells, chemistry, the body. You've worked with so many themes.
Yeah, but it's called life, you know? And you know, every smell I do is heritage or preservation of a kind because the smell in next second is different. So I've also done a lot of work on emotional artifacts, smell artifacts, 3D objects.
That reminds me, actually, I wanted to ask you to speak a bit about your work with the city of Detroit. And I just came across this pretty recently when I was doing some research for this chat. So
yeah, I'm Broad, Broad Museum and the Ford Foundation. So we are building a permanent archive on life in Mexico Town and Little Island. And it's going to be a permanent collection. And it's looking into language, street language, and poetics and Motown. So I'm working with a lot of poets and musicians to record real life in the street before those respective neighborhoods will be gentrified. And they decided, because they found it so important what I did there for the Broad Museum, they found that so valuable, they offered a whole floor for the archive when the building will be ready. It's a process. I'm on the board of the Science Gallery in Detroit. So we are moving towards to make a physical entity to keep all that information that I worked on for a year and to continue it also. Yeah.
Super cool.
But for that specific project, we looked into the area around the station where they're going to renovate now. Ford took it over and it's become a kind of tech park. So very much of that surrounding there will be gentrified. You know, not only I work a lot, but also a lot of what I do will also slowly be placed back in the world where I kind of did my research. Also, I'm building up a big bank of molecules in the next to the seed bank in Svalbard and Spitsbergen in Norway. Yeah,
that's very cool. Wow.
Yes. So that's also a very interesting project I'm working on at the moment with the Norwegian government. And then we are looking into various other issues in Scandinavia with relation to climate change, with Greenland and Svalbard and Iceland, and, you know, to join the forces up there and try to do research in a different way to make this topic of weather and climate change accessible for people, you know. Words don't do it anymore. And images, we are tired of it, you know. So bringing emotion on stage is essential to action. What smell does, as we just said, it adds joy and play to the topic. And that is so essential for change of the rhetoric and to have one confirm the issues of concern with a different mind. All this bad rhetoric that we are now so sick of does not do it anymore. We need to change the mood. And it's possible, you know, again, being children towards the issues, curiosity and emotion is important to learning and to change.
Well, Cecil, as expected, that was a really fascinating talk, and I am very grateful to you for spending so much of your time with me.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're listening to Perfume on the Radio.
On Lookout FM.
If you're just tuning in, that was Sissel Tolas, Norwegian-born artist based in Berlin and the hardest worker I know. For more information about Sissel, please consult a search engine near you and prepare to spend some time reading through the results because she has a very extensive practice. And as a final reminder for those of you based in Norway or ready to travel there, Sissel's solo exhibition at Astrup Fearnley Museum in Oslo takes place from October 2021 to January of 2022. If you can go, please do. Okay, it's time to wind down our sixth episode of Perfume on the Radio, which we called The Sissel Show for perhaps obvious reasons. Now it's time to thank some people. Credits for this episode go out to Maxwell Williams for the snappy title music, Stephen Rimlinger for the melodic interstitials, and Cameron and the whole team at the very awesome nonprofit radio station Lookout FM. We got the music for this episode from Muse Open and the Open Music Archive, and we list it on our website at perfumeontheradio.com. It's all in the public domain. Perfume on the Radio is produced by the Institute for Art and Olfaction, which is a nonprofit devoted to experimentation and access in the field of perfumery, based in sunny Los Angeles, California. I'm Saskia Wilson-Brown, founder of the Institute for Art and Olfaction, and your happy hostess for this episode, which, like all our other episodes, will be archived on perfumeontheradio.com. If podcasts are your thing, you can also download it on a podcast provider of your choice and enjoy it in a location of your choice. This week, I'm daydreaming of listening to it in Oslo in October on the deck of the Astrup Fearnley Museum after having seen Sissel's show and with a nice fancy museum coffee in my hand. Before I sign off on this episode, I wanted to share a little bit about our next show, in which we will be exploring mythical beasts. A whole host of fantastic guests will talk about the smells and tastes of magical, uncanny, or extinct beings, from Bigfoot to fairies, from the Minotaur to mermaids, from Aphrodite to a T-Rex. It's such a good show, and I can't wait to share it with you. In fact, I thought it might be fun to share a little preview now.
You're listening to Perfume on the Radio.
On Lookout FM.
Bayana Davis works in the Flavors Department at International Flavors and Fragrance, otherwise known as IFF, and I asked her to explore the tastes of a mythical beast. Here's Bayana.
I want to preface and say that I do not condone the eating of any magical creatures.
Right.
They are rare and deserve protection. But as far as a decadent delicacy go, they are really a gourmand's dream.
Totally.
Also, I wanted to take into account these kind of magical creatures' diets and what I think they would eat, because that would also kind of give some guidance as to what they potentially could taste like and then what they could be paired with for flavor. So I thought about vampires. I mean, who doesn't love a good vampire? So they have a really high plasma-based diet mixed with kind of low shelf stable properties, right? They would actually make for preparation to be really tricky. I think the flavor would potentially fall within something like a veal or an olive wagyu. And I feel like, you know, with vampires' kind of immortal properties, they would allow for these really umami flavors to appear, to taste kind of young and delicate, and even supple just for a brief moment. So the flavors I would think to pair with a vampire, of course, garlic.
Right.
But also I would think of things that are coming from the earth. So, I mean, they are in coffins normally and they're underground. So things like mushrooms, like the finest truffles and radishes, carrots, and even like rare potatoes, like Russian banana or Adirondack blue, with these high quality like sages and thymes. and you know, and fully a pun intended on the time as vampires are immortal.
So veely, umami, earthy things. It sounds pretty delectable.
Yeah, to kind of play off kind of the blood richness, the iron notes that come through.
That was Bayana Davis talking about the flavors she imagines for and of a magical, mythical creature. You just heard about how she would flavor vampires, and you can join us for episode 7 of Perfume on the Radio to learn about how she imagines the taste of fairies and mermaids. She will be joined by Dr. J.W. Dotson, perfumer Lakenda Wallace, artist Boris Rowe, historian Jessica Murphy, perfumer Antonio Gardoni, perfumer Spiros Strasopoulos, and the Institute for Art and Olfaction's own Director of Operations, Minetta Rogers, and the episode airs on April 8th of 2021. And to reiterate her earlier point, neither Bayana nor the Institute for Art and Olfaction encourage the eating of magical beasts. It has been my pleasure to host this show, and I hope you got a lot out of my conversation with Sissel. As always, we will share this episode on our website, perfumeontheradio.com, and if you're curious about us, you can learn more about what we do at the Institute for Art and Olfaction at artandolfaction.com, all spelled out. So I'll see you in a few weeks, and until then, friends, keep it kind, keep it real, and keep it smelly.
What is that? The scent of death?
Perfume on the Radio.
You're listening to Perfume on the Radio.
On Lookout FM.